Kia ora. Ko whu smithaho. Nā mai ki te whare. Welcome to the House. It's the end of another week in Parliament, a week where the two major stories were probably the passing of two COVID bills under urgency, which actually took most of the week, and of course leadership ructions, and everything else was somewhat obscured by the dust and noise. Here on the House, you may be relieved to hear, we're ignoring the party leadership dance and instead looking at the divide between Parliament and government, and the role of the Speaker in that divide. The relationship between government and parliament can be confusing. Many people fail to differentiate them because under our parliamentary democracy, the governing parties also dominate the legislature, the parliament. Otherwise, they can't govern. And yet, there is still a vast gulf between government and parliament, especially between their roles. This is obvious in committees and becomes especially obvious when governments decide they need to move quickly.
I move that urgency be accorded the passing through all stages of the COVID-19 response vaccinations legislation.
On Tuesday, the House went into urgency to pass two bills related to COVID-19. The first of them enabled the new traffic light system and employer vaccine mandates. So it was significant, contentious, and as Chris Hipkins told the show at the beginning of the week,
it is a very technical and complex piece of legislation.
As you can imagine, the poor souls drafting laws in the Parliamentary Council's office have probably had a busy few weeks trying to get it perfect. But only they and government had seen it until Tuesday when it emerged for an end-to-end debate. This urgency starkly reveals the natural divide between government and parliament. Because while governments want to make good laws and pass them efficiently, parliaments are jealous of their own role in that process of scrutinising and improving legislation. National MP Chris Bishop opened his third reading speech on the bill like this.
The House is about to pass one of the most far-reaching and significant pieces of legislation that this Parliament will consider, and the House has had precisely 24 hours to look at it. 24 hours for the first reading, the second reading, the Committee of the Whole House stage, and now the third reading. As Dr. Dean Knight of Victoria University, that very fine law school, says, sir, it is a constitutional disgrace.
Well, of course he did, I hear you say. Oppositions almost always portray urgency as a travesty of democracy. And yes, you would be partly right. Oppositions do often rail against urgency, and then, when in government, they use it themselves. But it's not just about being in opposition. They also do it because many opposition MPs come to see themselves as the foot soldiers of Parliament, defending the bulwarks of due process against the invading hordes of government. Or something equally stirring. And then there's the Speaker.
Urgency of this type used to be common. It isn't anymore, for good reason. It resulted in bad law.
Speakers are both Parliament's servant and its representative. If the role of Parliament has a champion, the Speaker is it. A good Speaker stands somewhere between government and opposition and probably annoys everyone on all sides over time by championing the needs of the House over the needs of the parties. So in that vein, before the third and final reading began for the first of the two COVID bills, Trevor Mallard had a word with the MPs.
Taking a bill one stage per day and using even a truncated select committee process improves the understanding of legislators, allows for informed public and specialist comment, and generally improves the quality of the legislation. This policy first became public on the 15th of October. The policy decisions, the drafting instructions or an exposure draft of the bill could and should have been made public and preferably considered by a select committee either through reference through the House or using committee's inquiry functions. The failure for that to occur is primarily the government's responsibility.
As you heard, on behalf of the Parliament, the Speaker had a bit of a swing at the government. But as I mentioned earlier, speakers have an unusual perspective and they see the flaws on all sides. So equally, he admonished Parliament's foot soldiers.
No member of the House requested any use of the inquiry functions at any of those committees, and therefore it is a matter which has widespread responsibility.
In other words, it's all very well for the opposition to lament and denounce urgency, but they too had known the policy outline, but yet took no initiative in carrying out Parliament's oversight and inquiry role into something that was very likely to be legislated under urgency. It's true that select committees have wide powers and can preemptively launch inquiries into, well, whatever they want. Backbenchers from across the House might have spent the last few weeks hearing evidence, having briefings, allowing a public view and informing their own views on the best approach. Now, regarding the role of the Speaker in this natural tension between Parliament and Parliament's subset, the government, I was intrigued by his comments, so I went to the source.
I see the Speaker as having a responsibility for looking after processes around the Parliament and trying to... There's been a lot of knowledge built up over the years about the best way of doing legislation, and generally Parliament works that way. Works much, much better than it used to in the past. You know, certainly in the pre-Palmer times, urgency was used extensively. Select committees were pretty rarely used for legislation. And there were lots of errors. You know, that was the expectation of Parliament would come back and fix them. My view is that wherever possible, urgency shouldn't be used to pass bills. Sometimes, you know, there can be, and it's appropriate to have very short select committee processes. Sometimes there are different things. You know, select committees can, if they know an issue is coming down the track and it's going to come down in a hurry, they've got an inquiry function.
They can kind of investigate what could be beforehand.
Yes. People have known since early in October that we were going to have a vaccination certification scheme. And any one of about three committees could have had a look at it. You know, Finance and Expenditure, Government Administration, Health, any of them could have had an inquiry. And I'm... So, you know, while I have criticised the government for the process...
But you also criticised the committees for actually not taking the initiative.
That's right. Any member of any of those committees could have taken the initiative. And I think while some of the blame, much of the blame around process... goes to government. Although, again, I want to say sometimes things are happening in a hurry, and clearly the international evidence, what works, what doesn't work around COVID is changing a lot. There were court decisions which impinged on this and, you know, would have changed the approach that the government had to use. But the general idea of the certificates, rather than the detail of the law, committees should have had a look at.
It's not just urgency that your role tends to sort of have this voice on. I mean, like on occasion you stand up and chide ministers over written questions, say, or for that matter, chide the opposition on not making quite a good enough fist of asking questions. Well, you push everyone to run the process better.
Yeah, and I've got to be really careful because I'm sort of like the referee, but I'm also, you know, the guardian of the process, and there's a little bit of coaching involved in doing the job.
MPs actually do come and ask you for coaching.
MPs quite often come in. I've had two in here this week, asking about, you know, trying to work out the appropriate ways of doing the supplementary questions in order to stay, you know, within the standing orders, to get the question that they want, to try and elicit the answer that they want, but cognizant of the fact that it's not always easy, and people test things with me. You know, is this in order? Is this, if not, why not? And build their knowledge that way. And I think that's important. And I think that's the best way of doing it. I think one of my faults is a bit often in the House, I probably try and coach the whole House while I'm refereeing. And that's probably, you know, that's...
It's fascinating for the rest of us.
Well, I certainly see quite a few members diving into their Speaker's rulings and having a look at, you know, at some of the historical stuff, and that's good. I mean, I think people should look at them more. I'm not always right, and standing orders and Speaker's rulings are, as they say, living documents. You know, we review the standing orders every 3 years, I always want to improve them. But looking at what the rules are now is a good place to start.
As it happens, on Thursday in the House, the Speaker found it necessary to school the opposition on the rules around supplementary questions. A couple of different opposition MPs had each begun with the broadest possible inquiry.
To the Minister of Health, does he stand by all of his statements and actions in relation to health?
And then followed up on that generality with questions that required an extraordinary grasp of detail, especially as the answers were being given by others on the Minister's behalf.
Is the Minister comfortable that 1 in 9 working...
The 27,433 people...
That 79,200 people...
Of the 284 ICU beds...
...support 40,000 people into jobs...
...has four resourced ICU beds, but only three ventilators.
In which case, you heard a lot of answers that began like this.
Mr Speaker, I don't have that information in front of me, and if the member wanted to be more specific, then she should have put that into the primary question. But what I can say...
The Speaker reminded the opposition twice that you can't expect specific answers and supplementaries that follow on from a very general primary question, and that those follow-ups should relate back to it. The Shadow Leader of the House, National MP Michael Woodhouse, begged to differ, which flowed into a conversation that the Leader of the House, Chris Hipkins, joined in on.
What I would point out, though, is that the Speaker's ruling you reference doesn't specifically rule out the questions. It just says that the questioner can't expect a specific answer. The second thing I would say is that it does make it rather difficult when we prepare on the basis that the Minister is there to answer the questions and an associate or other minister is asking on their behalf.
Mr Speaker, there are regularly occasions where ministers are unable to be in the debating chamber at any given time, and the solution to that, if members who are asking questions wish to ensure that the minister who is answering, regardless of whether it's the usual minister or someone standing in their place, if they ask more specific questions, then they can expect ministers to be prepared in detail to provide detailed answers.
Chris Hipkins meant a more specific primary question. The ones that ministers get in advance, the ones that warn them to prepare for questions on a specific area. Trevor Mallard again.
I think the Lady of the House has got it pretty well. As people are aware, I was a former Minister of Education. We had over 10,000 ministerials a year, 10,000 separate things that we dealt with individually in a year. And what that meant was when there was questioning about things, frankly, there was a big proportion of those that were not front of mind, and therefore an indication of the specific area of questions meant that the minister could come prepared. And both members have drawn distinctions where there's a member answering on behalf. But frankly, even as the primary minister answering questions as detailed as the two we've had from here now, it is, I think, unreasonable without proper notice to expect ministers to answer those questions in detail. They are very specific, they are important questions, and if members actually want answers to them, then an indication of the direction of travel would certainly assist them in getting answers. If people don't want, you know, real answers, then we'll have what's happened here today.
And in case you wondered what 10,000 ministerials would look like, I understand that a ministerial could be any memo, policy, cabinet paper or similar official document that might cross a minister's desk, any of which could be the subject of a question. So you can imagine that having some idea beforehand what kind of details might be required would be much more likely to actually enable an answer. Education, like a number of ministries, are gargantuan behemoths to stay on top of. You've been listening to The House. It's a whakarango koe ki te whare. He hotaka poake nā teitahi pūtia awhina. Nō mai. I te paramata. Mātawa.